So the title of my growth point session tonight is God-centered marriage. The goal tonight is to view all conflicts as distractions. They're all distractions. They're distractions from God occupying a prominent place in our life. So God wants to be the prominent thing in our view, and anything that gets in the way of that, it dethrones him. I've heard it said that your central focus, whatever you're centrally focused on, that is your God. You know, we in our modern culture, we say, well, we have no idols. We don't have, well, New England has a lot more of them than I've ever seen. Generally, they're out in the front yard doing this, you know. But we have no idols. But we do have idols. You know, anytime something takes the place of God in our life, that's our idol. You know, we may not have set it up on purpose, but it's just become that way, you know, because of our circumstances. So if I were to ask you, you know, again, what your God is, some people might say money, influence, friends. But I don't think it's unreasonable to say that our God oftentimes is trouble. That our God oftentimes is conflict. It becomes, you know, the only thing we're focused on. We almost worship it. I mean, this isn't titled. I didn't write this with, you know, the coronavirus in mind. But what has been humanity's God for this last week or two? They have worshipped at the idol of this virus. This virus has gotten, you know, more attention than God has gotten, I'm sure. And it's become their God. So I want to bring up some specific conflicts in marriage, but before the specifics, let me give you a broad brush truth from the Bible, that all contention is a result of pride. The Bible says it clearly. If there's contention and conflict between two people, you can put money on it that pride is involved in either one or the other person. I can make the bold statement because it's in Proverbs. It says only by pride cometh contention, but with the well advised is wisdom. So pride, you know, somebody says, well, you know, I'm not proud. The conflict is still there. Well, is it in the other person? You know, you're not in their head. You may not know what's going on in their life. Well, it's probably in the both of you. In my case, most conflict that I'm involved in, it's both of us. So contention, it's a matter of perception. So open your Bible. If you've got an app, turn there. We're in Philippians 2. Contention, it's a matter of perception. It really determines, it's really based on, you know, what are you looking at, how you view other people. Philippians chapter 2. I'll start reading in verse 4. Look not every man on his own things, but every man also on the things of others. Let this mind be in you, which was also in Christ Jesus, who being in the form of God, thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, and took upon him the form of a servant, and was made in the likeness of men. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. So verse 4, Jesus was others focused. Look not every man on his own things, but every man on the things of others. I mean, that verse alone flips the entire world system on its head. Because all the way down to our marriages, what are we concerned about? Us. You know, I'm going to get mine. Well, no, Christ said, look not every man on his own things, but every man on the things of others. If you're focused on what you need or what you want, you're self-centered. Pain, by the way, pain is self-centered. In its nature, when you get hurt, you're not paying attention to the people around you. You're paying attention to your pain. Okay? So people who are hurting, they're self-centered. A lot of times when you're dealing with somebody and they're in pain, they're hurting other people, give them time. Give them some time. Hopefully the pain will subside. And you know, try to work on whatever that you know, immediate pain is, and then come back to the point. But look not every man on his own things. Christ was others focused. Verse 6, Jesus had no image to maintain. And this one's big. He wasn't trying to maintain an image. Verse 6, who being in the form of God thought it not robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation and took upon him the form of a servant and was made in the likeness of men. So what do? We get offended when somebody attacks our reputation. And the truth of the matter is, most people are dirtier than their insults. I mean, if you found a little bit of truth about me and you ridicule me and you hack my reputation, if you could read my mind, you'd have a lot more against me than what you found out. So Jesus had the pure reputation, innocent, absolutely spotless, and yet he didn't made himself of no reputation. You know. So what do we do? When people come after us, we defend ourselves. Probably some of the best advice I received from an old pastor was, stop defending yourself. Only defend yourself when your reputation, if the damage of your reputation damages your ability to preach Christ, then defend yourself. But if it's not going to damage your ability to preach, just let it go. Just walk away from it. And lastly, verse 8, Jesus humbled himself to meet the needs of others. And being found in fashion as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient unto death, even the death of the cross. So Jesus, he deserved everything from us, and he received nothing in return. But it cost him everything. So contention and conflicts are going to come. Even Jesus' life wasn't smooth and easy. But how we view people will determine whether the conflict is external or internal. You know, life isn't always going to be easy. But one of them, it can hurt you externally. The other one will wreck your spirit. And how, you know, how you handle that conflict, I think is how you see the other person. How little you see yourself and how big you see the other person. You know. So there's conflict that comes up in your life, and you can diffuse it. It doesn't have to be a fight. It doesn't always have to be a fight. So conflicts by name, I'm going to name some things, and then you know, I'll stop at the end and I'll open it up if you want to speak. But there's three conflicts that I want to specifically name tonight, and it's not, you know, honestly some exhaustive thing. It's just three that, you know, me and my wife talked about and spent some time talking with other folks what they struggle with. So the three are in-laws, some would say outlaws, in-laws. Sex, intimacy, and money. And these three, they're going to be grossly simplified. Really what I want to do is I want to toss some things out and maybe start a conversation that you could have with your loved ones. So the best advice I ever heard concerning marriage is this. This is like quotable. And I didn't come up with it. Good Christianity makes good marriages. You know, you can read all the books you want, but if you neglect God's way, there's no advice for you. I don't know how many times that somebody's asked me for my advice. I quote scripture. I try to walk them through some biblical principle, and they're like, "Well, you know, tell me what you really think." I got nothing. I mean, if you won't do it God's way, I have nothing for you. But good Christianity makes good marriages. So if we promote good Christian behavior, good godly lifestyles, it will result in better relationships, better marriages. Just by default. So the Bible has a lot to say on marriage and relationships. We don't need a doctorate in philosophy to navigate trouble. Maybe it'd help, but what we really need is a tenderness for people, an understanding of the Bible, and a willingness to listen to the Holy Spirit as He prods us, saying, "Hey, you know, quit talking right here. Hey, maybe you should talk more. There's a problem. Let's deal with this thing." So in-laws, number one, in-laws or outlaws. This one here, the problem I think here, it arises from something bigger, and it's proper boundaries. Because you can't change your in-laws. I've got amazing in-laws. My wife, that's a toss-up. My father-in-law, when we got married, he made it a point to tell me, "I'm not going to get involved in your marriage." You know, he said it in front of her, you know, with me in earshot. He says, "You got a problem with your husband, you deal with it. You want to talk about it with me, fine, but I'm not getting involved. You take care of that relationship yourself." But when you have in-laws that don't respect boundaries, you can't change them. At that point, you really need to be you really need to have some good conversations with your spouse. You know, most people in marriage, they would say, well, what are problems in a marriage? And they would say in-laws, they'd name some other things, and they say communication. I think communication is, it's going to be in all these things. So I don't want to break that point out aside. So every sporting event, it has boundaries. The game is contained within boundaries. If a football game could migrate out into the parking lot, it'd be nonsense. If a hockey game could take place in the stands, you know, it's just going to cause all sorts of trouble. And the same thing's true about marriage. When people cross lines, everything goes wrong. Okay, you can have a great marriage, and your in-laws are crazy, and it's going to cause trouble. It's going to cause trouble between the husband and wife, because if it's a husband's family who's crossing lines, the wife's going to get upset. If it's the wife's family that's crossing lines and the wife's not doing anything about it, the husband's going to get upset. And it's just going to cause trouble in a marriage. So God, he addressed some things. And flip to Genesis 2, Genesis chapter 2. God addressed this because this boundary needed to be established. The problem arises when the responsible spouse lets their family cross lines that God established. And I say responsible spouse because I am convinced that if your family is the one crossing the lines, then you deal with it. It's just the luck of the draw. If you got great family, fine. If you don't, ask God for grace, but it's your job. So Genesis 2, verse 23. And Adam said, "This is my bone, this is now bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she is taken out of man. Therefore shall a man leave his father and mother and shall cleave unto his wife, and they shall be one flesh." I don't want to insult you, but the word therefore, you know, you've heard it possibly said. If you want to know what a therefore is there for, you look before. Okay, so therefore it's a cause and effect word. It's tying the two clauses together, and it's saying because of the facts in verse 23, the effect is in verse 24. That's the logical outcome. So let me read it this way. Because a woman is so intimately connected to a man, the new union must be separate from all previous relationships. And God takes the greatest relationship before marriage, the mother-father relationship, and says even the greatest needs to be severed. Because the relationship between husband and wife is so close that even mom and dad can get in the way. So if you let your parents inject trouble into your marriage and you're not fighting back, you're setting yourself up for problems down the road. The relationship between my wife and my mom has been strained from time to time, and this biblical truth has helped. Part of tonight, I just wanted to be frank about some things. This biblical truth has helped me keep things in their proper place. You wouldn't be able to, you know, I'm not able to fix every conflict. Every problem that comes up, I can't make it all better. But I can address it. I can do damage control. I can keep my house peaceful. I may not be able to keep everybody else's house peaceful. But at least what goes on, you know, behind my door can stay calm. And our team is still strong. But you need to nail down some things. One practical thing is we need to recognize that our spouses need to take priority over our parents in every case. I mean, even if our parents have some logical thing that they're wanting to see done in our homes, it's not their home. It's not their home. So here's some practical takeaways. I've got three of them for you. Acknowledge when family oversteps boundaries. Here's kind of a team thing between Sammy and I. If, you know, let's say, I've got, this is a hypothetical, but let's just say that we come over for dinner and my mom's asking, when's baby five coming? Well, maybe, and again, this is hypothetical, but maybe my wife and I, we just found out that we're not able to have any more kids, and we're just keeping it quiet from everybody. So when my mom brings this thing up and starts stepping over boundaries, my wife is dying on the inside, as you know, because this thing isn't public. So if I, as you know, the son, my mom's making the fence, she's stepping over all these boundaries. If I act like it didn't happen, we're going to leave and drive away, and she's going to say, why didn't you stand up for me? Why didn't you tell her to be quiet? Why didn't you, you know, or 2 weeks down the road, something comes up, and then she points back, well, 2 weeks ago, you said. So at a bare minimum, acknowledge it happened. Look at your spouse and go, you know, you can't always stop your in-laws from running off into some craziness, but you can at least acknowledge that they stepped over some boundaries. So that's just a practical, just acknowledge that it happened. Second one is don't make your spouse compete with your family for your affection. I've seen this a couple times with, you know, daddy's girls and mama's boys. They never divorce their parents. They get married, and now it's like, you know, this weird thing where husband and wife are married, except, you know, anytime her dad comes around, she just like ignores her husband. Actually, he doesn't exist. Okay, that ought not happen. I mean, it should be so clear. It should be so clear that your spouse has your attention, your affection, all the time above anyone. The last one I have for you is discuss how you're going to deal with difficult family members privately. If you see something coming, you know you're going to go to a family reunion. You've got that uncle. I don't know what he's going to discuss. You always know that he's going to meddle. He's going to get in your business. Something's going to come up, and somebody's going to get offended. Talk about him before you go meet. Don't wait until you get there. You know, if you know a problem's coming, chat about it in private. And then you, as a family, you know, again, if you win out and you've got the crazy one on your side, you deal with it. So I don't know if you have anything you want to add here to what has helped you navigate in-laws, but I know that for some people it's a problem. Yes, sir.
I've got great in-laws. I would like to believe my wife also has great in-laws, but I want to say something advocating for the in-law side. I think that a great advice for parents is to recognize if they really want to maintain a close relationship with their son or daughter, the best thing to do is establish a loving relationship with the in-law. So that they're the older ones. They're the mature ones. They've been around the block a lot longer. And if they think that they can be rude to their daughter or son-in-law and yet continue having a healthy relationship with their son or daughter, be married to this new person, they're mistaken.
Yeah.
And I would say it's the responsibility of the husband and wife to watch out for their marriage. And if that means they have to say no to the in-laws and walk away, that's a shame. It shouldn't have to be that way. The older ones, the more mature ones, should say, we're going to love our new son-in-law like a son.
Yeah.
What's going to happen is when the dad comes around and the daughter loves him like a father, the son will not be offended because that son will also love him like a father. And then vice versa. If the mom comes around, the son hugs on her, that's not going to be a problem because the daughter-in-law will be hugging on her as well because the mom will love both equally.
Good.
So that's my advice for how to maintain a healthy relationship with the in-laws, but that has to be on the in-law side.
Yeah. Yeah, so now that was good. Because we didn't have a mic, I'll repeat some of that. But on the in-law side, when somebody marries into the family, treat them like your child. And that would take away a lot of that conflict that, you know, that's amazing. That's great when, you know, I've seen it many, many times where a young couple gets married and, you know, the son-in-law is calling the parents mom and dad. Like, that is so good. I think that's good and proper. I think that's how it ought to be, the best way. So, anyone else? All right. Second one, I stuck this one in the middle. It's the sandwich theory. I like to deal with the worst things right in the middle. That way I can move on and get on to something else. So this one here is sex, intimacy, and this one here has, I think it's rooted in ministry here. Okay. So sex problems in marriage can be catastrophic amongst Bible believers. I mean, it could be catastrophic amongst heathens. And I've listened to grown men cry because their wife refuses to acknowledge that his sex drive is higher than hers, and it's resulted in a sexless marriage for months and years. And this guy, you know, the one I'm thinking about, he's just brought to his knees because of the temptations that are just beating up on him every single day, and his wife has just neglected this thing. So So just as a problem with in-laws, it speaks to a bigger problem with boundaries. I believe sex, too, it speaks to a larger problem regarding expectations. We're afraid to speak of expectations. If our expectations are too high, if our expectations are too low, we just don't have the conversation. Okay. The sinful world, it has no shame. It'll discuss sex with anybody who will listen. And Christians, on the other hand, I think we create a problem because we won't discuss it with the people who matter the most. We just act like it doesn't exist. You know? There was a young couple that sought out my wife and I for counsel. I think we'd been married 8 or so years, really close to this couple as singles, and they were going to get married. Both come from very, very solid Christian homes, and the young man approached me. He says, "Hey, my parents have never had to talk with me." I mean, the guy's 22, lived as clean as he could, and he said, "I have no practical idea how this works." He was talking about intimacy, and I'm like, coming. So my background is heathen and godless. I didn't come up in a Christian home. I didn't come up clean. I like to tell people my dad was a sailor and a trucker, okay? So a public school kid. So almost everything I learned the wrong way. Okay? And I saw the problem immediately injected into this new marriage because they have no clue and nobody was willing to just have a frank conversation with them. So to one extreme, they're vulgar and they're dirty and nasty. And to the other extreme, it's ignored and neglected. And as biblicists, I think that the greatest thing I've learned is balance. There ought to be balance. Okay, we ought to be able to deal with tough issues, but we ought to be able to find a middle ground where we can operate. So the greatest truth regarding sex is to acknowledge who created it. You know, the heathens, they talk about it, you know, much more than we do. But the fact is that God created it, and He didn't create it for their sinful pleasure. He created it for His children. Okay, so. You know, even godless psychologists, you know, they'll admit that married couples enjoy intimacy more often, more passionately than singles. Married Christians, we shouldn't fear to discuss anything that God ordains. Just, you know, it might be uncomfortable at first, but what I've noticed is to start the conversation is absolutely terrifying. But once you start the conversation, then it's like, oh, hey, you know, we both have a concern here. And then the conversation begins, and then only good comes out of it. It might be rocky at first, but, you know, again, we need to talk about it. Another truth regarding sex is that, you know, there needs to be an understanding of expectations. You know, what are my expectations? What are her expectations? And we all have them in every area of life, and intimacy is no different. So historically, you know, I had to go to WebMD, you know, because it told me I had cancer, I was going to die next week. So, you know, it's perfectly accurate to get all of your health scares if you want to be freaked out. But historically, WebMD says that men have higher libido than women. Although, you know, I've sat across from a married couple where this, you know, the opposite was true, but the rule stands, okay? WebMD states that on average, men consider sex once a day, women only twice a week, okay? So, expectations, they're there, and we need to have the discussion with our spouse. Most people would believe that mismatched sex drive creates problems, but I believe because of the previously acknowledged thing that God created it, then in our mismatch, there ought to be something great. There ought to be something, you know, that God ordained in this thing. You know? So acknowledging God as the creator, there must be a way for this mismatch to promote a healthy marriage. And I believe it's here that we find the element of ministry enters the conversation. And I'm going to go to Song of Solomon. Go to Song of Solomon, chapter 5. I'm going to read you a narrative, Song of Solomon, chapter 5. I like how the Bible addresses a lot of this because it veils it. You can read over it. A child could read through it and never really grasp what's going on. But if you just read a little closer, a lot of times God can teach you, you know, some sensitive things, you know, without being vulgar about it. So Song of Solomon, chapter 5. And verse 2, it's the woman speaking, the wife. She says, I slept, but my heart waketh. It is the voice of my beloved, my husband, that knocketh, saying, open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my undefiled. For my head is filled with the dew, and my locks with the drops of the night. She says, I have put off my coat. How shall I put it on? I have washed my feet. How shall I defile them? verse 4, my beloved put his hand by the hole of the door, and my bowels were moved for him. So she, you know, her heart broke. Verse 5, I rose up to open to my beloved, and my hands dropped with myrrh, and my fingers with a sweet-smelling myrrh upon the handles of the lock. I opened to my beloved, but my beloved had withdrawn himself and was gone, and my soul failed when he spake. I sought him, but I could not find him. I called him, but he gave me no answer. So in the narrative, Solomon came to his wife after she'd gone to bed, and the encounter is familiar to you if you've been married for any period of time. Some things kept you both apart, whether it was an argument, overtime at work. I mean, he's the king. Okay? Surely he's dealing with some political matter, and it's got him up way, you know, late at night, and she goes to bed, and you know, there may not even been a squabble. So one of them goes to bed, but the one who's awake, they can't quit thinking of their spouse. And they can't wait to come home and enjoy some you know, quiet time together. So not thinking clearly, the sleepy one makes some silly excuse and brushes off the desires of their spouse. Well, I took my coat off. I can't put it back on. You know, I washed my feet. I don't want to get my feet dirty. Okay. The expectations were not met, and now a problem's been created. The tired one tries to reconcile the problem, but because emotions are high and feelings are hurt, now the resolution is not going to be easy. It's not going to be, you know, a quick, like, I'm sorry. You know, now Solomon feels belittled, you know, like, you know, he came vulnerable and he was turned down, and now he's hurt. So I believe there's almost always a mismatched sex drive between spouses, and there's a healthy, and I think this is healthy because it creates a craving for one to the other. You know, a relationship where both spouses are independent and need nothing of the other, it's not a relationship. I mean, you know, I hate the term partnership. We're not partners. You know, there ought to be a craving in marriage. You know, if anything, just to spend time with them. You know, well, you know, my wife or my husband, they're kind of independent, and you know, but I'm not. You know, I really want to. You know, there's some people who are snugglers. There's other people who are just like, you know, and it's weird how God matches them together. So what about it? Should the, you know, the person who is kind of standoffish, well, they never come hug on me. Okay, well, God didn't design them that way. God designed you to be the hugger, you know, and they're kind of the they would rather sleep on the other side of the bed, not touching. Okay, there's people who do that, you know. There's others who, you know, they married somebody who can't sleep, you know, any distance apart. They have to be touching somehow. So God designed that. So the person that has, you know, that overwhelming attraction, chase your spouse. You know, I think that's good. And I think that's healthy. Okay. So 1 Corinthians 7, you know, just here talking about the husband-wife relationship. 1 Corinthians 7, we're almost through this. 1 Corinthians chapter 7. Verse 1, it says, now concerning the things whereof you wrote unto me, it is good for a man not to touch a woman. Nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and let every woman have her own husband. Let the husband render unto the wife due benevolence or affection. Okay. And likewise the wife unto the husband. Verse 4, the wife hath not power over her own body, but to the husband. And likewise also the husband hath not power over his own body, but the wife. In verse 5, it says, defraud ye not one another, except it be with consent for a time. Okay, defraud. What are we speaking about? We're speaking of intimacy. We're speaking of affection. So if you're going to lay aside affection for a while, the Word of God says it ought to be with consent for a time. And then it goes on. It says, that you may give yourselves to fasting and prayer and come together again, that Satan tempt you not for your incontinency. So I heard an old couple, and I think it was the wife who said it. I don't know what it is about older ladies, but they've always been really frank with their counsel. You know, they would ask. They'd say, how long can you fast and pray? You know, that's about how long you should wait. So here in Romans 1, Paul says the natural use of the husband-wife relationship is physical intimacy, And terrible things take place when all this gets out of order. Okay. Here, the warning is more severe. Satan is mentioned. In fact, the next verse we're going to read, Satan is mentioned again as being invited into the marriage, as being invited in to tempt. Okay. Here are some practical takeaways. And the next one's in Ephesians 4. So go ahead and go there, Ephesians 4. But some practical takeaways I've learned along the way is have a conversation about your expectations when the sun is up, okay? Because intimacy normally takes place at night and tired and late and whatever. It, you know, in our marriage, it's caused, you know, quite a few 3 a.m. conversations. I mean, you ought not be problem solving at 3 a.m. when you've gone through a whole day and like, okay, don't do that. That was bad things we did early on in our marriage. Okay, it was me. It was all me. It wasn't her. But when the sun is up, you're both wide awake, and there's relative calm in your relationship. Okay, so you know your kid slashed the neighbor's tires, and now you're out $5,000, and now you're going to discuss that part of your relationship. It's not the best. Okay, you should never discuss problems through texting. Okay, this is kind of a rule that my wife and I established. If there's a problem, you know, especially, you know, this area of life, don't text you. Don't text. Don't discuss it around kids, through kids, while your mom, or when either one of you are emotional and tired, you know, or hungry. For me, I'm just going to throw hungry in there. If I'm hungry, like, don't discuss serious things, you know, when life is just out of whack. So inevitably, one spouse, you're going to get upset, you're going to lay in bed for hours, angry because of an unmet expectation regarding intimacy. So there ought to be a biblical principle that will guide us through. If we're immature and we haven't dealt with this correctly and we've created this trouble, for the one who's angry, here's what the Bible says. This is for, you know, the one who's upset. So Ephesians 4:26. It says, "Be ye angry and sin not. Let not the sun go down upon your wrath, and neither give place to the devil." There he is again. And I put it this way. I believe that our marriages are so valuable that it's worth overtime. It's worth overtime. It's worth late nights. I think the worst thing to ever do is go to bed upset and be okay. Be okay going to sleep when your marriage is rocky. At least start the conversation before you go to bed. I would say make some coffee, wake your spouse, you know. There's my little one. I have nothing else sensitive to love, so it's cool. But wake your spouse, get some coffee, and say, "Hey, we really need to talk." And then let them wake up. And then just start like, you know, dumping everything on them right there while their eyes are they're glazed over. What I liked in our marriage is when I'm being immature, yeah, it happens. But when I'm being immature and I'm, you know, the way it normally played out in our marriage was I'd lay in bed and then I couldn't lay there anymore. I'd just get up and, you know, I'd go find something to do in the living room or whatever. So my wife would realize I wasn't there, she'd come chase me down. It's like, "What's wrong?" "Oh, nothing." No, something's wrong. "What's wrong?" And then she would start the conversation and we would talk and then we would work things out and it would always be better. Sometimes we saw the sun come up, but it would always be better. Other times, if she were being immature, and it's very rare in those cases, I would do the same for her. I'd chase her down. We just refused, you know. I think that maybe one or two times we went to bed knowing that the other was angry without working it out. But we made it a point to say, "No, we really need to talk. We need to work this out." Another practical thing that I've learned along the way is never withhold affection as punishment. That's the worst thing to do. Never do that. Literally, according to the text, you're literally inviting Satan in to tempt your spouse at that point. Historically, you know, I'm not being mean, but historically here it's women. You know, there was a story about an African tribe where the fellas were just being dumb. They were causing all sorts of conflict and trouble, and all the women got together and said, you know what, we can't speak to the politics, we can't stop them from fighting, whatever, so we're just going to make a pact, and we're going to be celibate until the men figure all this out. They figured it out really quick. Now, you know, if our nation goes that direction, and that's, you know, the spiritual ladies in the nation decide that's how they're going to solve, you know, whatever they need to solve, fine. But that ought not be how we handle our relationships. You know, if I'm upset with my wife and I decide, you know, I'm just going to walk out the door and go to work and I'm not going to give her, you know, a hug or a kiss and say I love you, that's going to hurt her. You know, that's going to cause some instability in our marriage. Something that we normally say if one of us are irritated and, you know, we go to walk out the door because we're not perfect. The other one, who's more mature at the time, would say, you know, well, what if you get in a car wreck? You didn't tell me you love me. It's like we don't want the other spouse to deal with that the rest of their life, like knowing that there was a problem unresolved. So again, just, you know, I think communication deals with all these things. So I'll open it up. If you want to jump into this one, do you have anything that you could add here? Again, I have some basic Bible principles. I just want to start a conversation, not necessarily here. No, that's good. For those who, you know, again, I'll repeat that one because it's good, but, you know, part of the WebMD, actually, this was something else they brought up, is, you know, you mentioned that women want, you know, more than just the intimacy where, you know, historically speaking, men are, you know, just wired for it, and there's nothing deeper to the relationship. You know. Whereas, you know, a woman... If a husband is not being a good husband, proper husband, loving her, caring for her, you know, spending time with her, addressing her needs, you know, in more than just, you know, intimacy, you know, in daily life, not taking her seriously, you said that would turn her off. And that's actually what, you know, one of the things that WebMD was willing to throw up there, to say, you know, what troubles come in a marriage. The thing that catches our attention is rarely ever the problem. It's always something underlying. So that's good. That's good. Good Christianity makes for good marriages. So, anyone else? Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I get it. Yeah, that's... Yeah. Correct. Yeah. Yeah, conversation, open, you know, just, you know, talking with them. This world would say that men and women are the same, and that's going to create so many problems in the future when these young people come up and they think that women are just like men and men are like women. because young men are going to assume, well, the woman wants exactly what I want, and the woman's going to say, well, the man wants everything I want, and that's not the case. You know, there's a complementary design there that I believe God has established, and if that's not acknowledged, we're just going to create problems. So.
I was reading a book on this topic from a Christian author, and he said he was counseling a couple, and their solution was there was a bell. When the bell was rung, the deed was done. The man or the husband, sure, the bell was there. They, if they had a little house bell, they rung the bell. That was their way.
If that worked for them, yeah.
To communicate in what they would claim a non-awkward way, but there you go.
All right. I've got some comments I want to throw in there, but most of this I approve with Sammy, so I don't want to toss out a lot of that. Good thought. All right. So, anyone else? It did get awkward at a wedding once. We had bells. Remember that, Sammy? And the kiss. And the kiss. Yeah. It was getting a little further than kissing. It was. All of us started getting awkward at that point. We were like, stop ringing the bell, and there's this little kid going. Like, it was bad. It was really bad. Yeah, to make me blush, it takes a lot, and I was dying. So anyway, anyone else? I am so thankful we did not put that little bell for, you know, forcing us to kiss every time.
I do think it's old fashioned that we think of old fashioned the parents talk to the children, but it's needed. Otherwise, you have that 20-year-old going to
yeah.
From someone who loves God and them, not from someone who hates God and them.
Yeah. No, I agree. Parents ought to, you know, we ought to have that conversation with our kid at the right time. You know, my fear, you know, as a dad, you know, my oldest is 11, getting ready to turn 12. There's a lot of those conversations they don't need to have right now. Like, you know, the world would have you doing sex ed, you know, with a 6-year-old. It's nonsense. Good heavens, no. But, you know, You're getting up around marriage age. It's about time to have a very practical conversation. So now Kentucky, I think we marry off at 14. So I mean, age appropriate, yeah. So I'm gonna toss this one out there. It's not in my notes, and Sammy told me not to say it, but I'm gonna say it. So in 1 Corinthians 7, it does say that, nevertheless, to avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife and every woman have her own husband. I will say a Jimmyism of mine. I'm a proponent of young marriage. There's a lot of sin that, you know, I talk with young Christian men, and they're all over the place in trouble and the rest. It's my opinion that this culture, this society, has pushed childhood off to 28 years old. And they've physically matured at, you know, 16, 17 years old. And, I mean, biologically, okay, just strictly biologically, I mean, they could have been married at, you know, 18, 19 years old and figured out life with each other and matured together. You know, they're both immature, you know. Do they have to wait till they're 35? You know. So I don't know. Like I said, it's a Jimmyism. I just think that that we do harm holding our kid back and telling them that they're not ready for marriage till they're 40. You know, what trouble do we get ourselves into? So anyway, that's just me.
Time to wash them.
Yeah, I think. I'm an AC man turned preacher, so I can't really speak to medical things. But I think what I've read, modern medicine would say 16, 17 for a woman is a healthy age to have a baby. By 18, 19, 20, she's more than ready. Again, it's just my fear that we've taken adults and we've told them you can act like a kid, you can act like a child, you can act like a child, and it's not the case. It's not the case. So either way, we ought to be telling our young people to mature. We ought to be putting some responsibilities on them and then letting them succeed, you know. So anyone else? All right, well, that was in the middle, so we're off of that. Money. This one here is not necessarily money as in debt and cash. This is more about work and making money. Listening to a handful of pastors go through marriage counseling and the rest, you know, they talk about money, they talk about debt, and that's trouble in marriage. I don't necessarily know anyone where money trouble is really big. I've heard cases of it where they're neck deep in debt, and everything they own's come from Rent-A-Center, and you know, now the bills are coming in, and you know, now there's trouble in the marriage. But most of the time, you know, when I hear of money trouble, or you know, it's overtime, or it's a husband who refuses to go to work. So most of the cases it's too much work. Very few cases, you know, they're deadbeat and they don't want to work. So regarding money trouble, I think the issue here is balance. Not having enough money or too much debt, it can be an issue. But I think the work-home balance causes more trouble than debt or being poor. Oddly enough, when I was sitting down talking with Sammy about some of this stuff, the poorest times in our marriages, that's actually the time that Sammy and I point back to some of the best times in our marriage. You know, when we were absolutely dirt broke and the car broke down, and I'm sitting out in the front yard working on the car for 2 weeks because, you know, week one I had enough money to work on it, but I ran out of money. I couldn't buy any more parts, and so the car sat. And then week two I'm out working on it because I've got another paycheck. And we just sat out, and she sat on the front porch drinking sweet tea, and we just talked and worked. And, you know, there's a meal that we made. Well, she made it because I'm worthless. I burned water. But it's three. She calls it her three rice dish. It's just three rices that she threw together. It has nothing else but three rice. You know, three things of rice. And it was actually a competition early on in her marriage for how little money could she spend. And I just, off the top of my head, I didn't write it down, but I think the cheapest meal that you spent to feed us all was like 14 cents. It was less than a quarter. Because she'd bought the ingredients and then she stretched it out over like three meals. We were poor, poor. When I got married, I was 23, she was 19. And the pastor really tried to talk us out of getting married strictly because of money. I made $11.50 an hour when minimum wage was $5. Okay. He wanted us to make $20 an hour. And this was in 2006. And I was like, please, no, like, we can make it work. And I think I even had to work out a budget sheet for him and show him, like, I can do this, you know. And then I got a buck an hour raise, you know, buck and a half an hour. So I'm making $13 an hour. I bought a house the next month. And so instantly house poor. But our fondest memories, I think, were some of the poorest times in our life when we didn't have distractions. We didn't have the money to distract ourselves with. We couldn't have bought a nice phone to play with, or we didn't own a computer. We couldn't go out on a date, so we had to just entertain ourselves. So no distractions. You know, a misconception among men mainly is, you know, I make money, I bring it home, that proves my love. I'm not responsible to work all night to maintain a healthy marriage. You know, a lot of my tradesmen friends would say, well, you know, I work 80 hours a week, and, you know, if I didn't love her, I wouldn't make that kind of, you know, that sacrifice. Yeah, but you come home and you're an absolute jerk, and, you know, you put nothing else into the marriage but your money. You know, what makes you different than a sugar daddy? You know, I just, I come around and I just give you money and now I just... No, no. Making money and making a marriage is not the same thing. I've seen some amazing marriages that were absolutely poor. No money. There was no money to talk about. And I've also seen marriages that had a ton of money in them and the marriage was shot. So God, He ordained marriage to require time and effort. I don't think God ordained marriage to require money. So, if I were to sit down and counsel with a young couple wanting to get married, money would be... It'd come up in the conversation. Can you support a family? Can you step out on your own and support one another? But beyond that, it's gonna get hard, but it's fun. It's stressful, but you figure it out. You make it work. So having a lot of money in a marriage won't help if God is missing. So my text is Psalm 127, and it's so common. Everybody knows it. Once I start reading it, but Psalm 127. What biblical principle would give us balance between work and money and our marriage? So Psalm 127, verse 1, it says, "Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it." Okay, so they're going to labor, but they're building in vain. "Except the Lord keep the city, the watchman waketh, but in vain." Then verse 2, "It is vain for you to rise up early, to stay up late, to eat the bread of sorrows, for so he giveth his beloved sleep." So if my life, so now I'm in a marriage relationship and my life is nothing but money, I'm going to wake up early and I'm going to impress my boss. I'm going to get there at least 30 minutes before everybody else, before my shift starts. And I'm going to stay, every time he asks me to stay late, I'm going to stay late. And I'm going to volunteer for every shift of overtime. And whenever there's an out-of-town job, I'm going to take that. And with no consideration to my other half. Okay? It's vain for you to do these things, to rise up early, to stay up late. Oh, I work so many hours, I come home and I should be, I should not have to put anything into this marriage. The bread of sorrows. No, God says he gives his beloved sleep. So many people rise up early, stay up late, and they have terrible marriages because they're not doing it God's way. God gives his people sleep. When everything's in its proper place, marriage works. It's not easy, but it works. So God even made it a point to tell newlywed Jewish men some interesting counsel. Look at Deuteronomy 24. God told a newlywed Jewish man to avoid going to war. Deuteronomy 24. Avoid going to war or starting a business for a year because he needed to cheer up his wife. And that's what the text says. We're going to read it. Deuteronomy 24, verse 5. When a man hath taken a new wife, he shall not go out to war, neither shall he be charged with any business, but he shall be free at home 1 year and shall cheer up his wife, which he hath taken. Time together is an aspect of marriage that God clearly ordained, and it gets attacked. If God ordains something, I bet you Satan's going to target it and he's going to come after it. And this is it. This is one thing. And then I consider, why does he need to cheer up his wife? I bet you there was some little bit of dishonesty in the dating relationship. And, what's the thing that, the knight in shining armor's turned out to be an idiot in tinfoil? No. And now she realizes, she had expectations, high expectations, and reality sets in, and God knows that there should be some time spent. You need to spend some time establishing, building that relationship. So in Daniel 1, I'm not going to read it for sake of time, but Daniel, he chooses to please God instead of pleasing the king. You know the story. He refused to defile himself with the king's meat. So he takes the relationship that he has with God and he says, and he weighs it with the relationship he has with the king. And he says, who am I going to please? Because you're going to please one, you're going to offend the other. And he says, I'm going to please God. And he handles himself wisely with the king. He doesn't just come at it and say, I'm just going to, So there's balance in Daniel's life. He says, you know, I'm going to please God, and it's not going to bring a life of ease, you know. So we're chasing money, we're chasing ease, we're chasing comfort, and our marriages are failing, you know. Or a bigger sense, you know, we're talking about a God-centered marriage here. Our relationship with God starts falling apart. Okay. So Daniel, he chooses to please God. You know, if I were to sum up this point, it would be that balance in the Christian life is summed up in a single question: who do you choose to please? Because you're going to make somebody mad. You're going to upset somebody. You know, and when I got married, I started deciding. It wasn't like, oh, you know, an epiphany. It was learning that when I please somebody else and I put my wife down, she would come to me and say, "You hurt my feelings." You know? And I realized, you know, this other person is really temporary in my life. I love them. I care about them, but they're really temporary in my life. My wife is my partner for the rest of my life. You know, who am I going to please? You say, well, what if my spouse is overbearing? Wisdom. You know. For the man, you know, the Word of God says that we should dwell with our wife according to knowledge. Okay. You ought to be wise. You know. But you ought to understand that you need to put some people in your life, and you need to realize that those people need to be pleased, and other people, again, be wise, but don't set them over your spouse. So who would we choose to please? Here's some practical takeaways that I've learned along the way here, and it's talk to your spouse regularly about your workloads. You know, first, you know, ask them from time to time. Just bring the conversation up. You know, am I working too much? You know? For one couple that I know, you know, ask, are you working enough? There was one couple that I knew. It was her complaint. We would invite them over constantly, and they were really close to Sammy and I. We just loved them to death, and she said, "He won't go to work." You know, their finances just worked at the moment, and he didn't really see the need to go to work, and she really wasn't interested to have him around the house all day. And she's like, "He won't go to work." But bring the conversation up. Am I working too much? Am I working not enough? And then hear them out. Just you know, and listen to them talk. And then have a conversation about, you know, about their schedule. You know, talk. It's a two-way street here. So you are literally a God-ordained team, and it's critical that you build each other up. If overtime is voluntary, which, you know, a lot of times in my trade in HVAC, a lot of my overtime was, you could get the overtime by asking for it if you've been there long enough. So the senior guys, we could get the overtime first, but there's always somebody who could take it. You know. So by me working overtime, a lot of times it was me volunteering to do it. You know. Something else, and this is, you know, this is something that I've seen a lot of guys do. You know, when the marriage is rough, they volunteer for overtime because they don't want to go home. You know, and I've seen it a lot in the trades. I don't know if it extends everywhere else to the white collar world and the rest, but when the marriage gets rough, they have satisfaction at work. They have a claim and you know, people building them up, telling them they're doing a good job. And then when they go home, there's just trouble, and they're not working some things out, or maybe it's just really hard, you know. They just volunteer for work. If a lot of overtime is not voluntary and you can't talk, you know, you can't get out of it, you know, talk to your spouse. Maybe it's time to consider a new job. You know, I would put employment below my spouse. You know, again, I'm about to blow the whole linear, you know, priority thing out of the water here, but your job, the way you make money, it ought to be flexible. So your marriage is not, you know. The last thing I've got, last practical thing on money here is spend as much time at home as you can. You know, I've never heard an old man say that he wished he spent more time at work. Never heard it. You know, Of course, you know, maybe it's different in New England. You know, the Southern retirement is sitting on a front porch drinking sweet tea and just wasting your life away. In New England, I think, you know, your retirement is to, you know, earn, you know, triple doctorate and, you know, work five jobs. different world up here. But I've never heard an old man say, you know, I wish I volunteered for more overtime. You know, he regrets missing games with his kids, school events. You know, here's the truth. You're rarely as important to your job as you think you are. Something that shook me to the core, just a few years ago. In fact, is one of the reasons I come to Connecticut. One of the senior technicians who trained me died of old age, and I picked up, you know, a bunch of his contracts. So I came into these commercial businesses and I said, hey, I'm Jimmy, I'm your new HVAC tech. Where's Rex? You know, where's you know, and you know, name the guy, and it's like, I died. You know, and they're like, oh, okay. You know, and that's literally where the conversation stopped. And it was like, oh, what are you going to do for me? You know, and we start talking about taking care of this equipment, and big industrial, you know, HVAC equipment can outlive like three technicians. So there's literally been not only him, but there was a guy before him that was trained up on the same stuff, and he died of old age, and now this guy, you know, is going to retire or pass. You know, so there's three people who've worked on this thing, and it's going to outlive you. It's bigger than you. It's bigger than you. Who did we hear it from? We heard it recently, and I think you, Pastor Russ, mentioned it in a sermon. You know, that the most important thing at your funeral is the food afterwards. After they lay you in the ground, they're more worried about their stomach and the fact that they're hungry. You know, oh, they're sad for you, but you know, they're more interested in getting that hunger fixed. So, you have anything practical that you might add to the work life, work home, work marriage balance?
You made a great point about men staying work because they're fulfilled rather than letting go home with no fulfillment. I found also similar to that is a lot of men who don't know how to deal with their own kids. You know, a lot of men have never learned how to deal with kids.
Oh, yes.
So they're scared to go home. They are tired of their kid. They can handle all of 5 minutes with their children, and that is it. So some men will actually time it, so that's what they get. They come home at 7:55, they have to get 5 minutes, and then they're done. And the wife is at home and gets the last 3 hours, and they wonder why their wife doesn't want to be intimate. They wonder why their wife doesn't want to talk to them. They wonder why the house isn't clean, and it is making matters worse. And they justify that decision by the noble statement, well, I'm bringing money home to the family, when, as you already said, the family doesn't need more money, they need more than that.
Yeah, no, that's great, and that's actually an issue in my life. Like, I'll just be honest with you. I have a harder time being a good, loving father. It is harder for me to be a dad than it is for me to work an 80-hour week. It's just counter nature to me. It's still clear. The Word of God in Deuteronomy, the weight that God lays on the dad to raise his children. It's not laid on the mom, you know. So, no, yeah. What for live stream? What Pastor Russ said was, some dads take overtime to avoid children because it's complicated. It's hard. They don't, you know. And then they just make up an excuse. No, I see that. I see that. Yes, sir.
You're in a marriage, it's 100% the husband and 100% the wife.
Yeah. Oh, definitely. Marriage is, yeah. Marriage is 100-100. You're right. And making more money, you know, you mentioned it was going to sacrifice, it was going to cause some sacrifices in marriage. Yeah, and you put marriage above it. Yeah, communication. Yeah. Good. Anyone else?
I can tell you that.
Understand.
The key is you can't control a lot of that, especially in the military.
Yes, exactly.
The key is what you can control. You have to make use of that time. That's the key.
Yeah. And now that's starting to warm up now.
That's the thing. I mean, like now, like, you know, like she was supposed to have a shower for these next Saturday. She's in the Navy, principal, all travel programs. But like, you know, I don't know what your situation is. They tell you this, you do that.
Yeah.
So I mean, it's the thing is if when you make those decisions of the time you control and give them more time,
right.
That's where your problem comes into play.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't get around what they can control you. In other words, if they tell you to do, you have to. But what you have to control of, you make sure you can take control of.
Yeah.
Don't let them run your life.
Yeah. And like when I was back on the line, I'm up here now recruiting. You know, it's a totally different beast in itself. Like back on the line, me and Chris were already used to that. Hey, I'm going to be gone for like 2 to 3 weeks out of the field doing something. We were used to that. And I'd come home, have 3 or 4 days as far as the term, and was fine to go out. Ever since I've been up here recruiting and how much other stuff has come up, as far as the longer hours, you know, during the day, and sometimes even during the weekend I have to sit here and actually do work. But this past weekend, you know, we weren't here this past Sunday, you know, time change. Not only that, on Saturday, I think it was 4 hours. Like keep soldiers and you know play various games. Yeah, it was fun, but I wanted to bring them, but I couldn't.
But that's out of your control.
But
you're feeling guilty about it.
I'm not feeling guilty about it. It's just like what happened to us that we feel like time and everything. You know.
I'll tell you something practical.
Yeah.
When she used to, I mean, it's a classic. I mean, whenever the snowstorm coming. We both knew what was going to happen. She was going to have to do a double shift, not a triple shift.
I got it.
We prepared for it. You know, right. It is what it is.
It's something practical Sammy did to help, because in the summer, my entry just ate me. I would wake up in the morning before the sun came up, go to work, and I'd come home after the sun went down. I just go. And, you know, she knew it when she married me. Winter was our time away. But in the summer, what she would do is she'd rescue me when I'd come off call or, I'd, you know, whenever there was a moment, she'd say, we're going. And she would schedule like a park day. She'd say, we're doing this. And I'd leave my phone at the house and I'd just walk away from, you know, all that. And she would pull me into the family. And we would now, you know, here recently, she's got us going on walks. Not that we need the exercise per se. But it's forced us as a family to do something together, you know. It's free and you know, good trails around here. So just, you know, again, practically, there's some things that, you know, if one of us are getting snatched out and we want to get back and we just don't know how to make that work practically, you know, there are some things that you can do. So. Anything else? All right, well, I'm going to try to wrap this up really quick because we're already over. But my conclusion, if I were to ask you to list your priorities in your life, most of us would write a descending list and put God at the top and then marriage. And then and like everything after that gets weird, you know. You know, you say, well, my children come first, you know. But then well, what about work? Because if your work calls and you set aside a date, now work becomes more important than your spouse. And, you know, I've worked on Sunday, so does that mean that work is more important than church? Well, at times... yeah, it is, you know, especially if you're a first responder and the rest. So that descending list, it's chaotic, and it honestly, it's just God, and then everything else, just we just like to stick it there, and we try to make it work. What I want to say is that God ought to be the middle of everything we do, and everything else is important in its time, but it can also be a distraction, okay? So I think that, you know, what one man say, he was a pastor, and he was talking to a cancer patient, and he said, you know, sometimes the will of God for you is to take a nap. You know, as a cancer patient, I mean, this guy is his body is just being destroyed by the chemo and the rest, and the will of God for him wasn't to run a marathon, it wasn't to go knock 1,000 doors and hand out gospel tracts, it was to go to sleep. The will of God for you sometimes just take a nap. You know, so does that mean that work, that his nap is more important than work? Well, yeah. You know, God's will for him was to take a nap, get some rest. So is family important? Yes. If God is a sinner, all these things will stay in their place. And that you know, at one time you may have to put work above family. Other times, you know, again, if everything's in its place, God will work all that stuff out. God has to be the center. So if I were to sum up everything and just walk away, I'd say that we need to have a God-centered marriage. We ought to constantly be refocusing on God because everything else is going to be a distraction. As good as it is, it's going to be a distraction. So I challenge all of us that we should constantly fight to keep God as the center and look at everything else as a distraction. So. Anyone else? All right. Well, we'll pray and close.